I think it's about time for us to settle into our class. If you would go ahead and open your Bibles to the text of Genesis and the 49th chapter. We'll be digging into those scriptures in just a little bit. Before we embark upon that journey, we're going to take a moment and approach God in prayer. So if you would, bow your heads in prayer with me at this time. Heavenly Father, we thank you so much for this wonderful day you have provided to us. It is our hope as we dig into your word that we mine the depth of your understanding. Help us to become genuine disciples of your Son. Help us to serve in any capacity that you ask of us, seeking only to glorify and magnify you. Help us to be the shoulder that the broken lean upon. Help us to be the one whom is a reflection of your glory. And please forgive us of our own sins as we seek you. We ask all of this in the name of your Son. Amen. All right, so in looking at all of the story of God's people in the text of Genesis, which is more broadly seen as the story of God himself, what we're finding and recognizing here is that God's plans always exceed what you see in the immediacy, the small parts of the text. From the very beginning of creation in Genesis 1, 2, and 3 to the expansion of mankind as God's people, God's reflection spreads across the earth, his plan begins to work itself out. What we're at here is in the entrance into the pressure cooker, that is Egypt. God has laid out some groundwork for what we will be able to see unfold in the next few stages. But what's right here is a transition point for these 75 individuals. 75 folks who are then safely emplaced into Egypt, become a nation of really unknown exact numbers, but probably more than a million by the time of Exodus. And then that group is charged first with the option to go to Canaan. They bounce off the edge of that because of their lack of faith and trust, and only just a smidgen makes it in to the promised land. But right here, it's the beginning of that seed expectation where this small family becomes a grand servant of, in the big plan of God. And even beyond that, we begin to see the unfolding sight of God as he identifies what in essence is the future for each of these families. Also, pay attention to this. When we identify each of the ways in which this patriarch, by God's plan, speaks of his descendants, it helps us understand why they moved in certain ways, why their behavior was as such during the course of their own individual journeys on the earth. Remember, in the course of this study, we've often asked questions like, well, why did Judah do this? Why is Reuben this way? And why did God respond to them? Well, in these blessings, God identifies for us some traits in their character that maybe we didn't have the full picture to. And with that fuller understanding of whom they were and what was going on, then we can probably see maybe a little bit of why God moved them in different directions. And so we step now into the 49th chapter, and we're going to look at 27 verses as the first chunk of it. And so we can go ahead and move to there. And as a reminder, this is kind of the immediate sections we've moved into to get to here, the few prior chapters. In verses 1 to 27, there are a list of blessings identified attached to these various individuals, which also, for our purposes, we need to also think about them as the tribes. It's not just about these people at this point, because it's looking back and it looks forward. And so it looks back to whom they were, but it looks forward to how they will be throughout each step of their future. And their future goes from this moment right there, and for our perspective, think about it this way, from this point right here until the cross. Even though we lose track to a certain degree of the individual members of these tribes by the time we get to the returned remnant from the captivities in Babylon and Assyria, these family groups still are connected to the worship of Israel. Even though it wasn't practiced in its fullness as it ought to have been, they're all still part of this bigger plan. And so that future goes beyond just until they go to captivity for that Babylonian and Assyrian sections, but also until the Christ. You could even capstone it this way. It really goes perhaps until John the Immerser, who is the last prophet of the Old Covenant. John the Baptizer. So you've got that whole, edge-to-edge view of these things. All right, so looking at the first section, let's go ahead and just read a small segment of it, and then we'll talk about a few of them in that view. Les, would you read verses 1 through 7 for us right now? All right, so does that look to you like just the happiest scene that you could possibly think about? If you're sitting there and you've got Grandpa, in essence, describing the inheritance they're going to receive. Remember, we just came from an earlier inheritance scene, right? Where you've got Joseph brought into play with Ephraim and Manasseh. And now he shifts to here, and the first thing on the table is Reuben. Oh, Reuben, you should have been first, but you're not. That answers some of our questions. Remember, we talked a lot about how come? Well, actions have consequences. Sometimes those consequences are immediate, where you actually learn of the folly of your ways the moment you make a bad decision. And sometimes those consequences roll with you throughout the rest of your journey. He wasn't cut off, though. It's an important recognition. He wasn't just, okay, we're done with you. But there was a change in the state of his service. There was a change in the state of his connection to all the things surrounding him. And it was tied uniquely to the atrocity of his actions. His horrible behavior pushed the change that we didn't really get all the detail from on the consequence side. But now we kind of see a little bit more of that. For Simeon and Levi, your swords are weapons of violence, it says in one of the translations. Remember, they were brothers in the fleshly sense, but brothers in the criminal sense as well. Their actions together changed the way in which Israel, this family of God, was seen by the nations around them. There's a big impact of that, and we can't, dismiss that. And you think about, okay, and the outcome for this, the outcome of the consequence of their choices is then shown with brutal clarity. And then Reuben, kind of skipped over him, we'll back up to a second there. He was firstborn, however, you see the outcome of his own sin. I think I jumped over and include that, but this is Simeon and Levi, and now we go to Judah, which is our third one. Sorry about that. Judah picks up here in verse 8, and Judah, thee shall praise thy brethren, it says in the King James. Thy hand shall be on the neck of thine enemies. Thy father's son shall bow down before thee. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, thou art gone up. He stooped down, he crouched as a lion, and as a lioness, who shall rouse him up? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet until Shiloh come. And unto him shall the obedience of the peoples be, binding his foal unto a vine, and his... Well, let's pause right there for a second. I want to bring in two things into the text. The greatest blessing for these brothers falls upon Judah. He was going to have preeminence amongst his brothers. And you think about the impact of how that all then is going to play out. Reuben should have been the first, then Simeon and Levi are discussed. Judah seemed to have this constant reaching up above his brothers. He always seemed to be the one who would be able to step into that new role and step into the new moment of service. And he compares him to a lion's whelp. It's the cub that would one day become the roar of Israel. You think about how God then refers back to the Son of God as a lion from that tribe. And so there's a broad and strong picture there. And authority is attached to it as well. Because Jacob states that the scepter of sovereign rule will not depart until Shiloh. Before I answer the question about the begs ask, what does that refer to? Who's Shiloh? What does the term mean? What does the idea mean? Yeah, tribute. Does that give a little... a hint or a tell as what might be the arrival moment? Close, because there's a tie-in together, because Shiloh is attached there. The time frame here, Shiloh, as it's translated for us in the King James, is a title that's assigned to the Messiah. That's where Melchizedek would come in there with Abraham. And so you have that broader sense of this is what's going on. It's going to be there until Shiloh comes. You could, if you want to make notes, and then the way to think about it, when it says Shiloh there in this context, this particular use of the phrase, you could put anointed, you could put Messiah, you could put for the Greek translations that we use, for Christ, until that moment. And you think about how that changed. The rulership of the kingship of Israel was through a family line that came through both this family group, but also through God's design for it to be so. Now, when Christ comes, his priestly side comes from the outer edges. He's a priest according to the order or priesthood of, I already gave it for us, Melchizedek, okay? But, who gave him rule and authority? God did. God granted that to him. Did he have the right because of his lineage? Yeah, absolutely. But he had the right and lineage over a small kingdom. Whatever would be the borders of Israel at that time, in the sense of the physical sense, he had the right for rule over that. But God granted him authority over what? All things. So there's the shift. From the royal line of Judah came the Christ, who had legitimate right to the throne, but God granted him all authority over all things for all time. And so his tribute, his offering, his role as the peace bringer, his role as the sacrifice, and his role as king superseded all of that. You can see some of that imagery coming apart, to fullness in, the text of Matthew. Matthew chapter 1, verse 1, all the way through, kind of brings us the picture of the lineage of Christ in regards to the earthly side. And Jacob here is prophetically showing us the larger picture of what Christ would accomplish, that all power, all authority, his preeminence, his might, his ability to forgive. And as we mentioned already from Matthew 28, verse 18 and following, all things then would be subjected to him in the very fullest of the sense. Picking up again there in verse 10 of chapter 49. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until tribute or Shiloh comes. And to him shall be the obedience of the peoples, binding his foal to the vine and his donkey's colt to the choice vine. He has washed his garments in wine, and his vesture is the blood of grapes. His eyes are darker than wine, and his teeth whiter than milk. Again, you have that fuller picture of what's about to come, the tie-in from earthly reign to heavenly reign. And then there's the bigger picture of the arrival of Christ into the sacrificial side. That's why the tribute Shiloh idea comes into play as well. Moving forward, let's go ahead and read verses 13 through 15. I'll move us down the road. Tim, do you want to read that for us?
Zebulun shall dwell at the shore of the sea. He shall become a haven for ships, and the border shall be at Sidon. Issachar is a strong donkey, crouching within the sheepfolds. He saw that a resting place was good, and that the land was pleasant, so he bowed his shoulder to bear and became a servant that forth led.
Now, there's a powerful thing in the Old Testament that we sometimes struggle with, and that's understanding the images that God uses to these people. Because do you and I look at the donkey and think that that's a majestic creature that is of great power? Now, donkey for us is kind of a subset of the mule, and it's like the lesser mule, and they're both stubborn. And so the stubbornness is all that we remember about them. But they're praised for their capacity to continue to work when other creatures give out. You know, their unique attributes that we have denigrated actually made them the best for the tasks that they needed to be engaged in. But we say, who wants to be kind of connected to that? You know, how many modern contexts do you have people that say,
well, that's what will be my nickname. I want to be referred to as a donkey.
There's nobody who wants that. Well, that was from an earlier, that's a long time ago. And culture changes a lot of how we see things. You know, for those who were involved in mine work and hand labor just 100 years ago, whole different context, whole different. It wasn't so, just keep that behind me. We don't want to see that. God then uses that illustration to bless and praise, for we would curse and diminish with the same image. So my point then to recognize is that whenever we come to a section of the Scriptures and we see maybe in books like the wisdom literature of Solomon and the Old Testament sections of Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and the Song of Solomon, and we see some of the images there, and we go, I don't know what it's talking about. Ask a second question. What would the Israelite who heard this thought of? Because once you find the answer to that question, the passage changes. Because you can make a connection to the beauty that is familiar to you, and you can say, oh, that's what he's talking about. Second thing is, generally speaking, for about 90% of that, if you don't understand the image that you see in those scriptures, step outside. Because most of the prophets pull poetic imagery not from the inside of the palace, but from the outside of God's creation. And so a lot of those images are things that are mountain scenes, they're farming scenes, They're part of God's glorious creation. If you want to understand it, you just have to step outside and look outside. And see, when it talks about the goats streaming down the hillside or various imagery like that, well, it's because that's what they saw. So you can step outside and you can see inside the Scriptures better that way. So with Zebulun, haven for ships, he's looking forward to their location and setting and God's plan for them. Issachar is described as being strong, but you don't bear many burdens at forced labor. It does attach into the character traits that we still recognize within that imagery. Moving forward, we'll pick up there in verse 16. And let's go ahead and read through verse 20 at this time. Roy, could you read that for us, verses 16 through 20? All the way to verse 20.
Yes, a cook shall overcome him, but he shall overcome at the last. Out of ashes his bread shall be back, and he shall heal a royal bond.
So here you've got the next segment. There's a couple more we'll hit at the end. To Dan, you're going to be a judge. There's going to be a level of independence eventually for them, but he describes them, in essence, your snakes. But two things remember. God, by inspiration, calls these blessings. Man looks back to that and says, but isn't there, it seems like there's always a catch. It's a description of also whom they are as a people. And here they are again, back up for a second, thinking about what's going on. This is on the deathbed section of a man's life. He's describing the inheritance of his family and what's going to happen to them. And he bluntly tells each of these young folks, by comparison, what's going on with him. There's a little sting in the heart of each of you. But it also will help us understand, and this is an important thing, this is like a Cliff Notes version to how to understand the people of Israel from Exodus forward. Because it comes from two sources. One, it comes from their father as a family figure. But more importantly, it comes from the Father who is in heaven. And he describes the character of these people in future tense. You're going to be like this. So when we're looking through the way in which the tribes interact with one another, this is a hint. This is a hint to how they're going to behave, how they're going to act. Gad is described, in essence, as serving as a defense. Their land was aligned to the east of the Jordan River, and they're constantly going to be in conflict. They're constantly going to be the source of the pressure of the nations around them. Asher, you will produce food bountifully. So the fertile soil of Canaan will be their location. And then given for us next beyond that is going to be Naphtali. And I'll read here verse 21 through verse 27. Naphtali is a doe let loose that bears forth, or that bears beautiful fawns. And then Joseph is a fruitful bough by the spring. His branches run over the wall. The archers bitterly attacked him, shot at him, and harassed him severely, yet his bow remained unmoved. His arms were made agile by the hands of the mighty one of Jacob. For there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. By the God of your father who will help you, by the Almighty who will bless you with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that crouches beneath, blessings of the breasts and of the womb, blessings of your father. The blessings of your father are mighty beyond the blessings of my parents, up to the bounties of the everlasting hills. May they be on the head of Joseph, on the brow of him who is set apart from his brothers. Verse 27, Benjamin is a ravenous wolf. In the morning, devouring the prey. At the evening, dividing the spoil. So there you have the fuller picture of those things. To Asher, by the way, you're going to produce food bountifully. To Naphtali, you are a deer set free. Full of beautiful words. And then Joseph, we'll get Benjamin in a second. We'll skip over Joseph. We'll do Benjamin real quickly. Benjamin doesn't have a lot of play in the story, right? Do we get to see his conversations with anybody very much? He feels like just kind of a pawn. You know, you gotta leave him over there, gotta leave him over here. He feels used a lot. But yet, here, Jacob describes him. Moses records for us that you are a ravenous wolf, a warring people who take my spoil. Now, in the future, yep, makes sense. But right now, what's going on? Because there's two tendrils. There's the right now, and then there's the future for each of these things. But then there's Joseph. Joseph is given, first in private, the large blessing that's connected to his sons rising in connection. But then, in the presence of all of his brothers, who, pause for a moment and kind of roll back the timeline. If this conversation took place just after Joseph described the dream that he had dreamed, and his dad gave him the coat of many colors, you're all going to be bowing down to me. They already hated it enough to throw him into a ditch and sell him off into slavery. And now, at this point in his life, they just got like basically blessing-curse combos. Even Judah, to a certain degree, it isn't all flowery. But Joseph, if you didn't know the rest of God's story, you didn't know all the other pictures, and you came in and you read this as the last will and testament of Jacob, who is Jacob's favorite son? Joseph. That's like, no question. But is there more to it than just that? This is not just about the favored son of one man. This is the interaction of God's plan to bring about my redemption and yours. And the blessings that flow through the faithfulness of Joseph accomplish stages of that plan. They accomplish the things that bring about the Christ, that bring about redemption, that allow the work of the apostles, that bring you and I the gospel. And so as much as we can see the physical connection of these things, the blessings that are laid out here also tie together very deeply and specifically to this bigger plan. Joseph here is mentioned in this sake, but he's going to be in the larger picture later down the road, seen by his sons, right? Because remember, his sons have been elevated in the place, where in his stead, in that sense of the relationship inheritance side. The lands of Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh, largest physical space, by an obvious portions. And there's no question that they had the largest. And it wouldn't be without problems, though. There is a little bit. It says, yeah, there's going to be many arrows coming your way. There's going to be many opportunities, but you'll survive. You'll thrive. You'll be victorious. God will help you. It's part of the picture. You're going to be made agile in that sense. God's blessings, then, as a bigger picture, would be with Joseph. And in the long run, he would be looked to as a tribe, as a source of strength, a source of positive influence, a source of spiritual leaning. And that's the interesting thing, because we know now the role that Judah has. Because you would think, well, shouldn't Judah, as a tribe, Christ is going to come there. Isn't that a great thing? Remember, the picture of God is never only about one person. not about one part of God's creation. They all work together. And so Judah, Manasseh, Ephraim, even Levi, Zebulun, Reuben, all of them together form Israel. It's a great way to think about some of the parallel between the way in which God used these various individuals and then these various tribes in building physical Israel, and then to think about the parallel that Paul talks about in regards to the body of Christ. Each of these traits by isolation that are identified aren't really useful. Whether it's the leadership side, whether it's the servant side, whether it's protective side of Gad, whether any of those things by themselves, but together, those weaknesses are counterbalanced by the strengths of the other tribes. And now the problems that Israel encounters, the problem seed is always spiritual rebellion. They seek after foreign gods, they leave God behind, they play the harlot in the spiritual sense. That leads to the fracturing of the tribes. Where once they would rise up to defend each other and to work with each other and to serve each other, fragments fall off. And as those fragments and parts fall off, then Israel as a nation of people in service to God diminishes in their strength. They're still saved whenever they lean upon God, but their reach diminishes, right? By the time you get to first captivity and then second captivity, there's no one else to lean upon. They reach the point where, well, the only thing we can do is reach out to the nations around them and around us and buy them all. And yet, had they strengthened one another, they wouldn't have to reach very far. Because all of their brothers would have been reaching the same. I'll go. I'll serve. They cut off their strength as they pushed each other out. And it's a powerful connection when you think about it now in Christ. Paul, by inspiration, describes you and I in very much the same way. That our strength not comes from the fact that we're really excellent at one thing, and we may be. It's that with our one thing, your one thing, and our brother's one thing, we make the body whole. And so step back for a second and think about each of these tribes, their weaknesses combined with their strengths, their positions, and see how God sees the bigger picture. Because it's not just one man that wanders through and then eventually creates the nation of Israel. God forged that. He forged it from each of these individual parts. And I think it's a powerful way to see these things and to see it from the bigger picture. Because it was never about them as individuals anyway. Further, you think about the way that these tribes would have then supported and leaned on each other. Levi's final role was what as a people? Priests. But how are they referred to when we first find them here? Violence. You know, not in the, you don't see that, do you? And yet, they serve that way. And again, those of Issachar or Gad, different roles. Hard beasts of service, hard men of the wall, that is constantly defending, if you will, against the assailants from the outside. They all serve together. They all have that broader perspective and picture. The next stage of the text is a powerful one. We've kind of hinted at it. And it is a reiteration first in verses 28 through 30 of the instructions that he expected in regards to his own passing. It reads, all these are the 12 tribes of Israel. This is what their father said to them as he blessed them, blessing each with a blessing suitable to them. Then he commanded them and said to them, I am to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite. In the cave that is in the field of Machpelah, to the east of Mamre in the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought with the field from Ephron the Hittite to possess as a burying place. in essence, by parallel today, bury me in the family cemetery. Throughout most of the eastern sections of the United States, there are tiny little graveyards. There's actually one that I just learned about that's on the grounds of Northgate High School. A little graveyard there in the middle of the school. Small farmsteads, small little church houses. When you go, if you've ever been there, same last name. Same last name. Same last name. That's, in essence, the physical side of these expectations. But there's a spiritual connection, too, because this idea of being with his fathers follows through Israel even until the arrival of the Christ. There's still that deep connection to the land, their burial locations, and even in the reverence to the dead afforded during the time of Christ, it was a really big deal. When the weak, committed souls would tell back to the folks that Jesus is dealing with and trying to get them to be more encouraging toward the kingdom, they say, well, I've got to go bury my dead. We sometimes make light of that and think, well, just kind of passing it off. And they probably were in one sense. Culturally, though, for their context, these funerals were huge. Emotionally thing, it's a big spiritual thing. It's not just a light thing. And so this is a tie-in to that. The text continues in verse 33 here. I'm going to read through the end of the chapter. In the verse 31, there they buried Abraham and Sarah his wife. There they buried Isaac and Rebekah his wife. And there I buried Leah in the field and the cave that is in it where were bought from the Hittites. When Jacob finished commanding his sons, he drew up his feet into the bed and breathed his last, and was gathered to his people. You think about the days of his life, the journey that he has been on as a servant. It's not one where you look at it and go, oh, that's a heartwarming tale. As we've said a couple times, the life of the patriarchs in the text of Genesis are not the equivalent to Hallmark movies. Those are touching and generally have a positive end, and they're written by the hands of man. But on the other end, God's hand writes this story too. And it does absolutely have the most powerful of endings. But they don't always see it. They're left hanging in the balance of what's next. But consider this. Jacob, 25 years prior to this, the end that he thought he was going to see, 25, 35 years earlier than this, was not where he was. He didn't know that Joseph was actually alive. He didn't know how God was going to finish out his promises to him. He knew that the promises were made, but didn't know how they were going to come to pass. When he goes back, and I say go back, when he leaves and goes to Egypt, we identified this one part of the text, to see Joseph was alive was enough. And so we look at the closing of his story and see him breathing his last, and we go, such a hard life. But he sees that in a different view. That's the pinnacle. If you think about what's transpired, okay. Awfulness, awfulness, sorrow, sorrow. He's alive. We're rescued. He's basically a king. He sent a huge group down to pull us to safety. We were going to die of starvation, and God's plan through my son rescued us. And now we're all together. So we see the end of that and go, hard life. But when we do so, we forget that God's blessings flowed through each step of those things. God provided for him. God protected him. God protected Joseph and all the knucklehead brothers. And at different times in your life and in my life, we're going to find ourselves stubbornly refusing to acknowledge that our name could have been Judah, Reuben, Simeon, Levi. But we want to think of ourselves as Judah and Joseph. God's plan saved all of them. That's like one of the most powerful parts. And then Jacob sees all of them saved and sees that even with all of the blessings, or all their weaknesses arrayed, God's blessing them. It doesn't say, you're awful, so you don't get nothing. It says, you're unique and useful, so you get this task. You get this responsibility. And their responsibilities don't match the way our sensibilities see their abilities. Well, Levi the priest, well, that was God's plan. Reuben, hello, well, that was God's plan. Judah, preeminence, that was God's plan. Joseph to blessing, that was God's plan. So in all of those, as much as we don't see ourselves as Judah or Levi or Simeon, remember God used them with their uniqueness and with their weakness and with their strength. This helps us also further refine, and this is the last major comment for the class this morning. It further refines this truth that's reiterated by Paul in the most clearest of ways. Grace is strengthened. Grace makes strong. That's where God's power is perfected, in our weaknesses. These various men with their weaknesses were made strong through the capacity of God's grace. For Paul, it was the understanding that the thorn in his flesh that made him humble, kept him humble even though he asked for it to go away. My strength is perfected in weakness. Grace, that's you and I. That's it for our class this morning. We're going to be looking into chapter 50. On Wednesday, which will close out Genesis, and then the following study, we're going to review Genesis as a whole before we begin to step into Exodus. We'll have a couple of breaks over the next Exodus section because we've got our gospel meeting and some other things coming up too. Thanks, everybody.